My name is Evan Cavanaugh. I work out at Spirit Rock. I'm the executive director out there. I am not a teacher out there, though I do occasionally serve as a guest teacher at Spirit Rock and other places. And I try to spend some time at the Monday 5:30 LGBT group that meets regularly once a month or so. I'm there. That's that. I practice in the Theravada tradition for lots of years now. I don't know, I'm guessing 13 or 15 years now, something like that. And I've done some training programs and all that kind of stuff. So. And I thought today that we would spend some time, and it's lovely that it's a small group, we can have some fun together. But I thought I'd spend some time talking about this path we're on, and maybe we can find ways to share with each other about this path we're on. It's kind of auspicious as you head into 3 or 4 weeks of just sitting, for us to investigate maybe what that means to us and why we're here, how we came here, who went before us, things like that. I know that I came to meditation because I was suffering, you know? Life just was hurting a lot, and I wanted it to hurt less. And I saw some people who had been meditating or doing meditation stuff, and they seemed to be hurting less, and I wanted what they had. And so I decided I'd kind of check this stuff out. It actually seems to have worked all these years later. Maybe it's just getting to be 48 years old that things get a little better, but I've seen some other 48-year-olds who are still, you know, hurting pretty bad. So I'd like to think it's all this meditation time that's helped. But, you know, what is it? What's up with this meditation stuff that makes a difference? Here we are, sitting quietly so that we can really see our suffering more clearly and feel it more clearly. That doesn't sound like much fun. And the world around us certainly hasn't gotten easier. If anything, the opposite is true. There's more conflict and more suffering available, more causes for suffering available in the world. And yet, kind of if we stay on this path, things seem to get a little better, get a little easier. In the long arc of experience, certainly we all have our ups and downs. Stephen Batchelor has this great thing in his book, Buddhism Without Beliefs, about a path, about finding a path. And I know that when I'm more in my suffering than not, it has a bit of a feeling of being alone in a wilderness or in some kind of adverse environment that isn't being very kind to me, and that I'm needing to kind of battle or resist all the time what's going on. And that those battles and that resistance take lots of different forms. And some of the forms that they take in this wilderness, in this forest of difficulty that is feels like suffering, is that I'm often assailed by doubt about what in the world can I do to hurt less, to have less suffering. I usually don't know where to turn. You know, and I imagine all those kind of palm fronds whipping me in the face as I turn around to try to go somewhere else, or tripping on the undergrowth or something like that. I'm quite often discontent with how things are, continually wishing them for to be some other way. I mean, the palm frond across the face is not pleasant, and I'm not just going, oh, unpleasant. I'm like, oh, you know, break that palm frond in this jungle. And of course, this continual discomfort about the way things are leads to restlessness, and it can manifest in lots of ways. But I'm generally kind of always about trying to make things different, and you know, whether or not I'm having trouble sleeping, I'm certainly not that. Kind of resting in that way. I'm certainly not resting in the present moment of what's true, continually trying to find some way other, of being other than what's in the present moment. And that restlessness most certainly leads me to seek comfort in other kinds of experiences, and whether those experiences are generally through the sense doors that I seek that comfort. So it can be touch or smell or sight or what are the other ones? Touch or smell or sight or thoughts, being another Buddhist sense door. And those can take the forms of daydreams or sex or food or smoking or drugs. Unfortunately, those things don't seem to offer any permanent fix. And so over time, I don't learn the lesson that that's something that works. And it just compounds my suffering because I have this expectation that something will change because of my efforts, and yet it doesn't. And then there are all these people in the world, all these people who kind of cross my path and get in my way and want me to do something other than what I'm doing, and I often just wish they'd go away. I have a friend who's really into something called the Enneagram, which is one of those personality typing things. I actually find a great deal of wisdom in it myself. And I don't know too much about it, though. She just repeatedly tells me that I have a subtype of an Enneagram 5, which means I just kind of want to go in the study and close the door and keep all those people out. Well, I got to tell you, my sense of ill will towards others can really reinforce her diagnosis of my subtype of being an Enneagram 5. So I just want them all to go away, except, of course, the ones who are really cute. And that, of course, just cycles the sense desire stuff again, which doesn't bring happiness. So it's really all a mess. And when I'm lost in that wilderness, life just sucks. So how many Buddhist teachers have you heard give this description of what life is? It seems like the beginning of a Dharma talk is always kind of like, oh yeah, things are really bad, but oh, have I got some wisdom for you, you know. So here we are in the midst of this wilderness. We all have our own versions of this wilderness, but we've all got this wilderness. And all of a sudden, for me, it's the palm fronds and the undergrowth and the jungle. And all of a sudden, I come across a path. And there's a break in the undergrowth. And I'm just like, wow, a path. And imagine the sense of being in the jungle and finding a path. Now, I certainly don't know if any of us have experienced that at coming to our first meditation class. But I suspect that because we're sitting here, some of us have been sitting here a while, in some sense we get a sense that this is a path, and it's a path worthy of our walking on, and that it makes a difference in our wilderness. It's a clearing in the wilderness. There's a little more light, the undergrowth doesn't hit you across the face so much, and there is definitely a sense of release and relief that someone knew the way out of the jungle. And even some series of people who have trod down the undergrowth knew the way out of the jungle. So this, I suspect, is the path we're on. And it's the way. It's a path. It's one way, certainly, just one way. And what are some things that are true about a path? These are many of the things that Stephen Batchelor points out in his lovely treatment of it in this book. I know that there are people who have found a way. So there's some sense of having compatriots, other people who've been in the jungle and have decided that this path they've made is the way that will bring relief. The existence of this path means that there are actually people ahead of me on this path. If I step onto it, kind of whichever way I go, there are people who have gone before, i.e. their footprints and trotting down the undergrowth, etc. They helped me. All of a sudden there's this clearing that didn't used to be there, and there are people I can now be grateful to who have trod this down for me. There is a concept of their experience which led them to break this path in the woods that I can be grateful for. So the relief, a release that can come from, oh, there's a place where there's light, there's a place where there's a footpath, there's others who've been here, is accompanied by a sense of great gratitude. And that is certainly a relief from the undergrowth and the palm fronds and the tripping, and there are probably tigers out there somewhere. When I walk that path now, And all of a sudden I see that there's, you know, a palm frond growing in, and I break it off. There actually begins to be a sense that my actions on this path might be of assistance to people behind me. So instead of being lost in suffering, I can make a difference in the world and in the lives of others by following this path. And that is really a lovely, lovely sense. It's a sense of self-worth, it's a sense of contribution and of generosity, and it's really quite pleasant. There's a way in which walking a path can give your very life purpose in a way that it didn't used to have purpose. And certainly, when we sit together, I think many of you who sit at home probably have the experience that sitting in a group, your concentration's a little deeper, and it's a little easier to hold your form. And in fact, some people only find their way to a regular meditation practice by having regular groups that they sit with. So walking on a path with others is much easier than walking it alone. And it's certainly much easier than being out in the forest. So the existence of this path is really comforting. Sometimes when we're on that path and we're sitting here and we're much more clear about our suffering because we're clearing away other stuff, so our suffering itself comes into greater focus, it sure doesn't seem like it's easier. And we want to kind of jump into that wilderness again. Some of us do, in fact, jump into that wilderness again. In the 12-step tradition, that might be represented by someone going out and using drinks and drugs again. In those cases, that's a life-threatening thing. But for some of us, our suffering can come in other forms as well that aren't so life-threatening. It's just kind of productive threatening or pleasant threatening or relationship threatening or other kinds of things like that. So here we are. We're walking on this path together. All of us are sitting in this room. We're walking on this path. And we're being helped by the people who went before us. Now, in our case, the Buddha, in our era, if you will, the Buddha was the first to walk this particular path, although I would argue that there are many humans who've walked this path of wisdom and enlightenment in one way or another. And all of the people who came after the Buddha, who also walked this path, and who have further illuminated the path, setting down their learning, their experience, and their wisdom in a way that might be more relevant to us and easier for us to hear. All of those people have walked before us on this path, and we get a chance to be grateful to them. Many of us have talked with our friends, our partners, our loved ones about the benefits we are getting on this path. And whether or not someone goes, hey, that's fabulous, I'm in, take me to the next class, there's definitely a sense of hope. There's definitely a sense of seeing a difference that comes. So they get a sense that there is a path, even if this isn't the perfect one for them. And it's doing a great service to the people who come behind us on whatever path they are on. Many of you may recognize the list I used earlier of the ways in which the jungle of suffering is uncomfortable to be the classic list of the five hindrances in Buddhism. Now, the collection of the five hindrances is actually usually taught to students who are in meditation and you start to get drowsy, and that's sloth and torpor, or you start to get agitated, and that's restlessness and worry. So it's usually about, you know, sitting on the cushion, and these are the things that take you away from your object of meditation. But I tell you absolutely that you can look at this list of things also as the list of things that gets in the way of being in the present moment in your daily life. And in this way, this is just one translation of the fact that this thing we're doing is training for daily living. It's not separate from daily living. We don't have over here a meditation practice and over here our friends, necessarily. We don't have a meditation retreat that we do once a year and that's the only time we calm down. Or, you know, we may have that, but it's not going to bring you maybe as much happiness as if you find in daily life some ways to calm down. And the tools you learn here in the Dharma and in practice are absolutely applicable and useful to everyday living, as I'm sure many of you have discovered. So, for instance, I'm now 48. I'll be 49 in another 6 months or so. And personally, over the last several years, I've had a drop-off in sexual desire. Now, I don't really notice in the moments when it's absent, but when I look at the arc of my experience, and I look back at the times in my lives when sexual desire had a much stronger pull, I actually have come to recognize it as being without a certain kind of pain that I used to experience. The desire for something that I wasn't having is a form of suffering, is a form of pain. And so I've come to be, I won't say always or thoroughly, but I've come to be somewhat content about this change that is taking place in my life, because there's actually less pain. And this is one way in which I can take a look at the teachings around sensual desire in Buddhism and apply them to my daily life and take some comfort in what's happened. Truth to tell, I think I probably have to reveal that it's not all gone. And when it's here, you know, when I'm looking at some handsome guy walk by in the street or something, when I'm here, I'm not always going, oh yeah, there's the arising of desire, you know, take a note of that. I often get lost in it. But this realization that the arc of desire is changing and the absence of it is pain is getting me closer and closer to the point where when it does arise, I can go, oh, look at that. Because it's definitely wisdom that is informing my relationship to desire. And it's the same thing is true for all of the hindrances and for many of the other concepts that we are taught specific to the practice of sitting in meditation and how we can apply those to our day-to-day lives. It shows up on the cushion and on our path day-to-day. So I'd like for us to do a little bit of an exercise with each other. And so I'd like you to find a partner in the room. Pick one of the people that you don't know very well. Okay? So on purpose, pick someone you don't know very well. And just team up and sit next to each other. And then I'll give you some instructions.
There are 8 of us, so it works great. Out. So we won't have to use you for it.
So, having just spent a few minutes talking about what takes us off our spiritual path and what keeps us on our spiritual path, using the traditional hindrances as a window for that discussion, does anyone want to share anything in particular that came up? Please.
It was interesting because there's certain things. The 5 hindrances, the way I read it, that keep me on the path.
Oh, well.
Okay, and so what keep me off the path is aversion, which is also hatred. And I find that much more pleasurable sometimes in, you know, thinking of vindictive plots and how I'm going to, you know, do something terrible to somebody. And all the teachings sort of disappear, and I go, oh my God. It's not that they don't work, it's just that it's like, okay. And the part that keeps me on is the restlessness and worry, because I was telling Dennis I used to hate the idea of having to sit here, because I just had this enormous fear of public speaking, and I realized I really don't care anymore, because I'm not a facilitator, I'm not a speaker, I'm a guy who's been doing this for a long time, and I know the routine, so I feel comfortable with you, and I feel that I can sort of just relate to you on a one-on-one. And so that's really helped, to just let go of all. And sometimes, like right now, I'm getting a little nervous again, because I'm always wondering, like, gee, am I revealing too much, you know? Because I tend to just, I don't care anymore. It's sort of transparency is much more important to me than living kind of in this closet. nobody can see me. Mm-hmm. And people have this idea of me that really doesn't exist.
They'll have that no matter what.
I guess so. and it could be wrong, it could be right. But anyway, that was my story.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks.
Anything else to share? That's a cool frame about the hindrances keeping us on the path.
Yeah, because that, how does worry keep me? And I was telling Dennis, I said, I worry, but that's the emotional part, and the restlessness is the mental part. And so I get to get a little retreat when I meditate, however you meditate, there are many forms of meditation, I get a break from that. I'm going to worry, but I know tomorrow I may not have anything to worry about, so.
And in the Buddhist sense, the both the restlessness and the emotional pictures are products of the sense organ of the brain, of thinking, in the Buddhist sense. So,
it's true.
Yes. Any other thoughts or sharing?
I could relate and feel what some of what Corey went through was a little of what I went through. We didn't necessarily speak to keep it in the framework of the hindrances, but so that was, again, it attested to the fact that so much of what we go through is in common. It's just part of our natural state to go through all of this. It's universal. But I also thought of what you just said, Albert, that when I'm going through any extreme state or any state of agitation or my relationship to not getting what I want or whatever, depression, but the breakthroughs, I've had little breakthroughs that keep me going, like the breakthrough on knowing impermanence. Oh, this is going to change. Look in the mirror one day and everything's funky and lousy, and then the little voice comes in. That's happened through practice for a few years. It says, it's impermanent. Doesn't mean to deny it, but just be with it, and voila, you know, the next day, hey, it's like smelling the roses again. And that's really been an absolute comfort and strength, is seeing just how it's, no matter what my mind state is, it's always changing. And under that is emptiness. So that doesn't change. That's been my latest thing of what keeps me on the path. Mm. It's just seeing the impermanence, the anicca.
Can I bring something up because it's sort of relevant to me, I guess? I lost a friend recently, not who died, but a friendship that died. It was actually a very flash in the pan with this woman who I spent like almost every day. And there was a disagreement, misunderstanding, and then she felt that she needed sort of time apart, and which I was glad to give her. And I, you know, sent her a card and I sort of apologized for anything I might have done to cause that rift. And I thought, this is impermanence. And but I still love her. I still care very much about her. And that doesn't have to change, although that could change. But I'm going to remain in that state. And then now we're starting to talk a little bit more. So I'm thinking, wow, that's changing too. I wasn't expecting that, which makes it more difficult because then you don't know how to relate anymore. But I just wanted to thank you because that's kind of something I was going through that was very difficult, where the teachings did help.
I still have this expectation that since I'm on the path, I'm not supposed to get any plum frogs whipping across my face. There isn't supposed to be suffering anymore because now I'm a wise Buddhist, right? And I've got all these tools. Oh well. Oh well, here we go. So it's, I mean, I guess if you get taught about a tool and don't use it, you very quickly forget how to use that tool. So we can be guaranteed a life of reminders how to use these tools. And so I think we'll need to get taught about them again and again. So, you know, what we really did today was we shared and utilized wisdom of people ahead and behind us on the path. We all trade places on the path depending on what's going in our lives on any particular day. So that's what we do, and that's what this group does on a regular basis, whether or not you do it consciously or you name it. You're about sharing wisdom and supporting others, sharing the wisdom of people who are ahead of you on the path, and providing wisdom from each of you, even if it's just your calm presence that helps other people carry on their meditation practice. That is sharing your wisdom that you gained on the path and helping others who are behind you on that path. So it's clear that the hindrances are going to arise in our meditation, and they're going to arise in our day-to-day life. And are there any other conversation points or questions? We've got just a minute or two.
Well, it's not all about suffering. I initially got into spirituality or the practice because I felt something wanting to emerge, and then I made the connection, framing that that was also to help with suffering or discontent in life. But it's always been there, some spiritual directive to want to explore. Mm-hmm. I guess it's the nascent Buddha nature.
So you've been a seeker. You've always been a seeker. Is that what you mean?
It's just something emerging, some part. And so it took me a while to understand, oh, this is helping suffering, that which is emerging. So.
One of the frames in Buddhism is that that sense of drive for something else, even if we imagine it to be a hoped for thing in the future, the drive in and of itself is framed as a certain kind of discontent or stress. Mm-hmm. So when I refer to suffering, let's not always do, you know, cut cheek from the palm frond across the jungle of, you know, difficulty, but even the most subtle reaching for something other than what's true at the moment is classified as dukkha, as suffering in the Buddhist frame.
I do have a question about, I don't know if it was Stephen Batchelor's metaphor or imagery or yours about trampling the path.
Yeah.
That I said that at the beginning and that you learned from that. I wanted to for you to clarify, because I also saw as when people trample, it's kind of like they leave footprints and they make a mess. And I think sometimes teachers and people on the path make a mess.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I learned, I mean, it's a great path. I mean, you sort of like, but I was wondering how you felt when you, because you mentioned it a couple of times, how the others have helped you.
Well, I tend to mean it in this example of the case of they've cleared away the jungle for me so that I can see a way to go. So I tend to think of it in a way as providing wisdom, or their experience has clarified the way. But I certainly take your point that, you know, all those little earthworms underneath have gotten hurt, and so there is a mess to be made along the way. And just because our teachers occasionally make messes doesn't mean that they're not also illuminating a way for us. And I think that's true about our friends, you know, as you said a little earlier, or all sorts of people who teach us while they're human, teach us while they are imperfect, and continue to be both an inspiration and a source of some suffering. So that's all part of the path.
I think that's sort of encapsulated by this inscription. There's a pilgrimage route in Spain, Camino of Santiago. Yeah, and there's a church towards the end of the pilgrimage route, and there's an inscription that says, "Pilgrims, there is no path, there is only traveling itself." Mm-hmm. So there is a path, but you still, or every given moment, you're still struggling to travel on it. So
I love in Please go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to piggyback on that. I was going to say, yes, I mean, I like your image of following the path, but I also know from my own experience and the other people that even though you're following a path, you're still creating your own unique path, too. That it's never quite the same as what you think it's going to be, no matter, you know, who you're following or whatever.
Indeed.
But in a way, they create an opening that what you do with it and exactly how you go about it are going to be unique to your own person.
We're blessed with that, aren't we?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It would be kind of boring otherwise, wouldn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
One thing about this path metaphor and stuff. In early Buddhism, before Buddhism met the Greek traditions in, I don't know, 200 or 300 probably, there was no statue or image of the Buddha. The Buddha was often represented by an empty chair, often represented by two footprints. I saw a piece of art in Delhi, in a museum in Delhi, India, just a while ago, and it was the soothsayer, the baby Buddha being presented to the soothsayer, which then the prediction came that this would either be a great spiritual master or a great warrior, and that unfolded the whole thing where his father kept him shielded so he wouldn't become a spiritual master. But the swaddling clothes were laid out on this pillow, and there was no image of a baby in this mm-hmm. in this carved relief. There were just two footprints. And I'm reminded of the travel in the path, and that in our age, with this particular wisdom that's arisen through the life of the Buddha, that it's a path that is being illuminated that we can create our own special journey on. So, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be with you again.